We've begun, I guess we will call it the long march through Daniel. several weeks ago, we're in Daniel chapter 3, and these texts are very long, as you can see in the bulletin. So I want to get into it very quickly with you, but as I read the text, let me just call your attention to a couple things you should look at as I'm reading it. The first, I want you to notice repetition. Names, phrases, activities. As I read it, it might sound a little wonky and belabored repetition at times, but Daniel is making a point. So just take notice of those. We'll talk about it in a minute. The other thing I want you to pay attention to is the relationship between worship and power. It is not subtle in this passage. Let's look together. This is Daniel chapter 3. I'll read verses 1 through 30. Hear the word of the Lord. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sounds of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the provinces of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent, and the furnace was overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." And then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
O you who wrote this story and preserved it, O you who presided over the protection of your people, O you who entered the fire of your own judgment on our behalf, I pray, would you be with us now? Would you help us, help me, your servant, to speak? I pray that you would help all of us to listen, that you would open our hearts, soften us before yourself to hear what you would have us hear. And I pray that you would help me. Would you give me strength of and clarity of thought and help me to speak in fidelity to you? I ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Some time ago, I heard a story about a young man named Tom. Tom was a college student, and Tom was in love. I mean, hopelessly in love with a young lady named Helen. And you knew, he knew, everyone around him knew just how much he was in love because her name just kept coming up in conversations. You know that state of a relationship when everything can somehow be brought back to this one person that you're crazy about? That was Tom. She was on his mind all the time. She would be, when he was in class, he might not as well have even been there because he couldn't concentrate. He couldn't think about anything else. And he was so in love with her that he wanted his parents to know about this relationship that he had with Helen. He thought there would be a future with her, and he wanted to bring them into the loop of what's going on. And so he decided he would send them a copy of his favorite picture with Helen. He had it on his desk. She had given it to him in a little frame, a picture of the two of them at their favorite restaurant. And so he grabs this picture frame, and he takes it. I think it was Walgreens, I don't know, it was one of those places, and he hands it to the guy, and he says, "Hey, can you duplicate this picture for me?" And the guy says, "Sure, I got you, can you just take it out of the frame for me?" And so that's what he does. He delicately, you know, takes apart the frame, and he pulls this little picture out, and he sees a note on the back of the picture that he had never seen before. "Oh, this is sweet. Helen left a note for me." And this is what the note said. "My dearest Tom, I love you with all my heart. I love you more and more each day. I will love you forever and ever. I am yours for all eternity. All my love, Helen." Come on. Oh, that softens the heart, doesn't it? And then he noticed there was a P.S. that said, "If we ever break up, I want this picture back." What is the fear in every relationship? It's the question, are they as committed to me as I am to them? And when that question is answered, I would propose you have a wonderful relationship. If that question is answered definitively in some way, where commitment is robust and runs both ways, and you don't need to ask, you don't even need to ask that question. That is a wonderful, healthy, and life-giving relationship. It's a person that you're so grateful for. But if that question is not answered in some way, then you're asking all kinds of other questions. Like, is it wise that I'm in this relationship? How possible is it for this relationship to be what I hope or want it to be? Am I safe in this relationship? And listen, we ask that question about just about every relationship in our life, romance and otherwise. We ask that question of our friendships. It's one of the ways we evaluate all of our friendships. Marriage relationships, that question's being asked and answered in so many different ways. Working relationships, is this person really committed to me? Is this person really committed to me for my good? One day, children will ask that question of their parents. And listen, God's people ask that question of God. This story is full of drama. When people stand up for what they believe in, it grabs our attention. When the powerful use religious coercion in order to get what they want out of the people, it grabs our concern. But listen, when a relationship that runs between God and his people hold up under such intense pressure, it should grab our hearts. That is what we are looking at in this story here, is the deep commitment that runs between God and his people. But God's commitment to his people and these three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their commitment to God. What I want to do with you this morning is just look in verses 1 through 15 and talk about how their commitment was tested. Their commitment was tested. And then in verses 16 through 30, I want to look at it with you and see how their commitment was demonstrated. Commitment tested, commitment demonstrated. First, let's talk about this commitment that's tested, verses 1 through 15. Nebuchadnezzar, he may or may not know just how deeply he is seeking to test the commitment of these three young men to the Israelite God, to Yahweh. But that's exactly what he's doing. Idolatry does that. Idolatry is fundamentally a test of our unilateral devotion to God and his attachment to our heart, our hope in him. But we get there because Nebuchadnezzar wants something. What does Nebuchadnezzar want? What is Nebuchadnezzar? Oh boy, that word. If I just shorten it to Nebu, will you know who I'm talking about? What does Nebuchadnezzar want? What does Nebuchadnezzar create to get what he wants? And then what does Nebuchadnezzar end up getting in the end? So what does he want? What does he create? And what does he get? First, what does he want? There are limits to how much we can really probe the mind of Nebuchadnezzar's thinking, you know, from our vantage point, this so many centuries later. But there are some indicators in the text. I would say they're kind of implicit. They're embedded in the text that let us know some, at least some, of what's going on in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar that invites where he creates the scene. Some scholars, this is because there's no time stamp at the beginning of chapter 3 that you see in many other places that tell us in what year such and such happened. There's none of that at the beginning of chapter 3. And so some scholars are kind of reluctant to actually link chronologically this story to the story that we looked at last week in chapter 2. But I just think the parallels we see between these dreams that Nebuchadnezzar was having and then what he does in this passage are really profound. If you were here last week, you would remember that Nebuchadnezzar was having dreams that troubled him. It said it troubled his spirit. It troubled him deeply. And these dreams were of Babylon, and it was telling him that his kingdom, this Babylonian empire, had an expiration date. And images, it was images, one image after another would arise out of the previous kingdom, inferior to the previous one, but would grow strong and displace the one that came before. Babylon was the golden image, and then there was another image and another image and another image. And so it just seems like it's got to be in response to this troubling dream about his golden image being replaced where now you see him in verse 1 setting up a golden image, one that is built to last. And he gathers all of the people in his diverse kingdom before this golden image to worship it. And it's mentioned several times. You saw it being repeated, O peoples, nations, and languages. See, the Babylonian Empire had expanded to now include all the people that they had conquered. And so it was a very diverse kingdom at this point. And so at the very least, you can say that Nebuchadnezzar wants unity and he wants peace in his kingdom. And that's not a stretch to say. But it seems like, and I'm just going to kind of press this forward a little bit with you, but it seems like he wants more than that in this passage, doesn't it? I mean, you notice that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up, King Nebuchadnezzar's name is used 6 times in the first 7 verses. Over and over and over again, it said Nebuchadnezzar has set up. He has attached his name to a statue that is built to last. 60 cubits is 90 feet tall, and that is massive. It is tall and it is slender, and we don't know exactly what the statue is. Some people think it's an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself. That seems unlikely in Babylon's history. They didn't really divinize their own kings the way that other empires did. I tend to think it's probably a statue of the god Marduk, but it doesn't matter. Nebuchadnezzar set up an image that he hopes will last far beyond himself. He's looking for a name that lasts. He's looking to preserve his glory. He's looking to control and counteract the promise of these dreams that he had just had. That's what Nebuchadnezzar wants. What you see here is not so much a definition of idolatry, but as a description for us of what it is, where it can come from, and the effect that it can have. What is idolatry? Hey, this is a conversation that is deserving of your attention for the rest of your life, okay? It can go on and on and on. It's worthy of self-interrogation, and we can't get at the roots of all of this here, but I'll say that idolatry has a prominent place in biblical concern from both the Old Testament and the New Testament authors. They are always mentioning a concern for idolatry, because what it is to replace fundamental worship of God, fundamental loyalty to God, hope in God, with worship of anything else. It's an attempt to draw something out of the world that can answer what the deepest longings of our hearts. I mean, that's what Nebuchadnezzar wants. What are the longings of our hearts? I mean, we all have them. At a basic foundational level, we all have basically similar longings. I mean, we want security. We want protection. We want provision. We want dignity. We need these things. And what idolatry is to find them in any place other than the promises of God given to us. It's to redirect our worship, or exchange, what Paul says in Romans 1, is to exchange the truth of God for a lie. And it's corrosive to our souls. It's a great concern. And what's interesting is, once it has its hooks in you, it feels like it can never let go. Because you see this in Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful man in the world. Okay? And the most powerful empire in the world at that time. He has everything the world could possibly offer him. And obviously it's not enough. So what does he create? Well, he creates an immensely pressured environment to compel others to join him in his idolatry. Idolatry thrives in a pressured environment. And here you see all kinds of pressures, right? You see social pressure, political pressure. Let's talk about political pressure for a moment. You notice that the names, like the titles of all these dignitaries, were mentioned several times over the course of this passage. It's making a point. Is everybody that had political or legislative or just some kind of ruling authority in the kingdom. It was all the governors, all the mayors of the cities, all the city council members and cabinet members. They're all invited. Everyone was there. everyone with any kind of sense of importance in the kingdom was brought in to this. You'd feel grateful to just be included in this gathering. There's social pressure. I mean, you're familiar with this. Everybody bowed the knee. I mean, how could you not? There's also religious pressure. I want to put this out there for you. This is not just a dedication ceremony. This is a worship service. It is cloaked in religious veneer. All the pageantry, all the music, all of these instruments, the finest orchestral arrangement at the time. It doesn't say they just bowed before the statue. It says they bowed down and worshiped the statue. It's like it's trying to sanctify this event in some way. And it seems like Nebuchadnezzar gets what he wants. Until verse 8, it seems like Nebuchadnezzar gets what he wants. Now, many commentators have noticed all of the repetition, especially in the first seven verses or so. And what's that about? It almost seems like Daniel turned what could have been two verses into seven verses. Like, why would you do that? And the point, many of them make this point, it's a theory. I'm not going to say this is fact, but I tend to agree with it, is that Daniel is showing how the people are just blindly doing whatever the king tells them to do. That you notice that. You see this over and over again. The king summons all the people in verse 2, and then in verse 3, all these people come, all elaborately repeating the same phrase. Verse 4 passes along the king's expectations, and then verse 7, the people do exactly what he tells them to do, all of it elaborately repeating what has already been said. What's going on here? This is what one person called Nebuchadnezzar's unthinking bureaucracy. Blind allegiance is what he's getting here. Unthinking, uncritical, unquestioning allegiance. They're just blindly following along the pressure. They're just doing whatever he tells them to do. They're just doing whatever everybody else is doing. Until verse 8. Why won't Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bend the knee? Well, one of the reasons is that they got their eyes open. I mean, they understand what they're seeing. These three young men are spiritually aware. They're theologically rooted. They're spiritually aware. They know that it's folly, that it's bad for them. They know that there's nothing that this statue or this powerful king can offer them that can compare to the promises of God in their lives. I mean, these are the wise figures in this story. And they understand. And just notice that this is probably the most polite resistance that you may have ever seen. I mean, they don't draw attention to themselves. They're not like making a grand protest where they're trying to demonstrate their resistance to what the king is trying to do. They just simply don't bow the knee. And if it wasn't for the Chaldeans outing them to the king, it's reasonable to think the king probably would have had no idea at all to begin with. They just simply won't bow the knee because they understand how corrosive it is, how the corrosive effect of attaching our hope to anything other than God to deliver on the promises of God that meet the longing of our hearts. And they know. They got their eyes open. They see through it all. They also know that this is one of the reasons that Israel is in exile. And this is one of the reasons that they're in Babylon to begin with. And they would rather die than bend the knee. Because listen, it's not just an outward demonstration, but it's about a heart level commitment to the only one that can provide what our hearts long for. It's interesting when you read in the Old Testament, it's really, when it speaks about idolatry or warnings about idolatry, it's talking about worship of a certain image most often. That's what they're concerned with. Don't have household gods. Don't take them with you as we journey. I mean, it's a theme that you see all through the Old Testament. But when you begin in the New Testament, when, you know, this multi-theistic or polytheistic cultures, some of those gods are still a concern. But also you see the New Testament authors point our attention to the things in our hearts that we often attach our hopes to that are also a replacement for God. They begin to raise concern about the way we idolize money or the way we idolize people's opinion. These things can come to rule over us. And the great concern, and this is what you see, John Calvin speaks about this. He calls our hearts a perpetual idol factory. I mean, the great concern is what we attach our hope to. And if we're honest with ourselves, we can attach our hope to all kinds of things that actually detach our rooted hope in the Lord. And that's what the concern is. That's what we see in this story. And we also see it in our own story, do we not? Wendy Witter is a wonderful Christian author, teacher. I could read her, I could listen to her speak all day long. She's really wonderful. She speaks to it this way. She says that our modern idolatries are much more subtle and insidious and even more powerful in our own lives. Beware, long quote incoming. Here's what she has to say. It's worth it. Actually, believe it or not, I shorted this. I bridged this down a little bit, but it's worth it for us to hear. She says, sometimes when I sit down to write, facing my computer screen with outstretched hands, I wonder if I am bowing before the God of prestige. And when I lie prostrate on the couch during prime time, it occurs to me that the God of entertainment and leisure might have taken up residence in my living room. That one cut a little bit, just so you know. She said, in the glow of the refrigerator, as I partake of unnecessary and even unhealthy calories, I realize I might be fellowshipping with the God of gluttony. And maybe when you kneel down to lace up your running shoes, she's offering no corner here. Maybe when you kneel down to lace up your running shoes, you can spot the God of self-image skulking at your feet, singing the praises of Gadget 5.0 while offering your credit card to the clerk. You might catch a glimpse of the God of technology next to the register. Perhaps the most pervasive idol is human autonomy. The right to do what we want, how we want, when we want, with whomever we want. If something makes us happy, we are entitled to it. If something makes us unhappy, we are entitled to get rid of it. Human autonomy is the God of gods, and we worship it fervently. She's comprehensive. I leave it to you to decide which one resonates with you. But one of the things these young men are teaching us is the importance of examining our own hearts for anything that we've attached our hearts to deliver what only God can deliver. I mean, we long for something physical, visible, smellable, if that's a word, but something tangible that we can attach our lives to, some person or some currency or some praise that we can hear. We long for these things to build up our hope. We long to attach our hearts to these things. And as Christians, we believe that all of our hope, all of our joy, all of our security is bound up in Jesus. Listen, an idol is a lot of things. But an idol will never die for you. Why, oh why, would we attach our hope, would we root our hope in anyone other than Jesus? And so just for the interest of self-examination, I would encourage you to take some time. If you don't already do this, I would encourage you to take some time and look at the good things in your life and just ask the question, what has become an idol to me? It's worth asking. It's actually worth asking with other friends who know you very well, who might be able to speak to you about this. It's a good community group conversation, because the truth is an idol almost always comes to us as something that's good, as something that's given to us, that God has given to us to be enjoyed. But listen, what if it were taken out of your life, would you just become totally undone by? Or you could think about the pressures that are in your life. Like, where are you experiencing intense pressure? Some pressure is good for us, but where might you be experiencing intense pressure that you really weren't built for? Some of us feel the pressure to be perfect in public, don't we? I mean, like, and not just like morally perfect internally, but we feel the pressure to seem perfect to others. And if I could just speak as a dad for a moment, that pressure, we can pass that pressure down to our kids just like that. We really can. Some of us feel the pressure to control. Control can be an idol. And so we need our hands and our eyes and our opinions everywhere. That's what, it's exhausting. It exhausts you and everybody else. And that's what idolatry does. It leaves us exhausted and it leaves us frail, because we can become so angry when we don't get what we want. And that's exactly what we see in this passage, is that what happens when Nebuchadnezzar doesn't get what he wants? He becomes furious. It's like he doesn't even have categories for it. When they demonstrate their commitment to God, Nebuchadnezzar just loses it. And it's also interesting to note that when they articulate their commitment to God over and against him, they also do it in the most polite way possible. They're like super polite. Verse 17, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar," this is very respectful. Later they'll call him King Nebuchadnezzar. They're not trying to diminish his power or his authority. "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." Another translation has this: "We have no need to defend ourselves." I think that's a really helpful way of understanding that phrase. They say, "Our God is able to deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Now, you have to think that the furnace was right there. Like, it was visible. All the people were there. That's another pressure point. And we know from Jeremiah 29 that King Nebuchadnezzar was just capable of this kind of cruelty. These are not empty threats. But what stands out in this passage amongst these three young men is their willful surrender. Verse 17, "God is able to deliver us." I know he is able to deliver. He's far more powerful than you are. And he is where our hope lies, not in you. Verse 18, "But if not," that's profound. This is the essence of true faith. It is entrusting yourself to the will of God. And it's not pretending to actually know what God intends to do. It's not pretending to know it. It's not posing as if they know it. Whatever happens, if they die, they die faithful. If they live, then God has demonstrated himself in a powerful way that nobody else could. They're just entrusting themselves to their will. I don't know if they're standing there totally confident before this king. I have wondered if they're afraid. Maybe their voices are trembling a little bit as they speak truth to power. I don't know. But what you don't see is anger. They're not raging against the king. They're not raging against the circumstances that they're in. They're angry with the Lord. They are willfully surrendering to his will. It's beautiful. Many of you know that I've been a fan of the man Ben Sasse for a while, and many of you, I know that many of you know this, because about 18 of you sent me a text with a link to the podcast that he did when he interviewed with Ross Douthat from the New York Times. If you don't know, Ben Sasse was a former politician. He was a senator out of Nebraska, U.S. senator out of Nebraska, and then he became president of Florida University. He's also a Christian, and I described him to a friend this way: as just somebody who has been able to make real sense of faith during difficult times. And he also wrote months ago that he was dying of cancer, that he'd been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And he wrote about all of that. And I would just encourage you to read everything that he's probably ever written. But he's very helpful as he talks about these things. And I would listen to the podcast interview. If you want a link, I can send it to you. It's not hard to find. It all is wonderful to hear, but especially the last 10 minutes as he speaks more clearly about his own faith in the face of his death. And what stands out to you is the peace that he speaks about it with. Like, there's real peace. There's peace for him. There's peace for his kids. He says, "My kids are theologically rooted." Like, this is hard. Like, I don't wish it on anybody, but I'm not afraid. And then at one point, Ross Douthat asked him toward the end of this, just the last few minutes of the interview, he said, I know that you have prayed for healing, and you haven't experienced healing from God yet. He hasn't answered that prayer in the positive. Are you angry?" And he says, "No," in his raspy voice, just very calm, "No." And then he says, "I have no idea how my death is woven into the tapestry of redemption that God is weaving." Why does Ben Sasse have peace? in the face of such difficult circumstances? Why does Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have peace in the face of such difficult circumstances? Because they know. And they don't know the path of it. But they know that the arc of history bends toward redemption. Because God is weaving a tapestry of redemption. And you see that in this passage. That just as they're declaring their commitment to God, God is demonstrating his own commitment to them. Nebuchadnezzar stands up and says, "Who is this fourth man in the fire? I don't understand. We threw three men in here. Now there's a fourth man. He appears to be a son of the gods." In Aramaic, that just simply means he must be a divine being. And he looks, we have no idea. And they come out. I love this. Verse 27, it says the fire had no power over them. Love that phrase. It's teaching us about the comprehensive care and commitment of God for his people. They didn't even smell like fire. You can't sit around a fire pit for 30 minutes without smelling like the rest of the day. They couldn't even smell like fire. Who was that fourth person? Some people think it was an angel. Nebuchadnezzar later calls it an angel. Some people think it's what's called a Christophany, that it was Jesus himself coming to be with his people before he was incarnated. We can't know. The disciples have argued about this, scholars have argued about this for a long time. The disciples probably just asked him, you know. But whether it's Jesus or whether God sent an angel, this is God doing what God does. This is Jesus doing what Jesus does. It's entering the furnace of our lives, protecting us and bringing us home. Egypt was described by Moses in Deuteronomy 4 as an iron furnace. Isaiah described the Babylonian exile as a furnace of affliction. And listen, in Matthew 13, Jesus describes God's wrath as a furnace. Listen, there are furnaces of affliction all through your life. We all have them. There's not one furnace that you are enduring that Jesus is not familiar with. Listen, you may feel the heat of people's scorn and ridicule. I'll tell you that Jesus knew that heat. He knew that heat his whole life, and he knew that heat as he walked up the hill carrying his own cross. Now, you may feel the heat of temptation. Temptation to sin. You may be dealing with besetting temptations that you just can't seem to kick. Listen, Jesus knew the heat of temptation. He knew that furnace. The Satan brought him out into the wilderness. Hebrews 4 tells us that he knew every temptation common to man, yet he was without sin. You may feel the heat of a body that feels like it's failing or just doesn't do what you need it to do. Or you may feel the heat of death itself. Jesus knows that heat. In fact, he embraced the heat with love for his people, for the joy that was set before him. He entered the furnace of God's wrath so that you never have to. Nebuchadnezzar says, "Who is the God who would deliver you out of my hands?" And then in verse 29, what does he say? "There is no other God who is able to rescue you in this way." Why would we hope in anything else? Let me pray. Oh, dear Father, I pray for your grace and your mercy over us. Help us to love this story and to find our joy in you. As these things in Jesus' name, amen.